Good evening, everyone. Clay uses that excuse, by the way, all the time. I've been up since 3:45. It's just cover, actually. No. Welcome. Don Gagne is going to come out in just a moment, but you are a part of not only a live event, but also a broadcast, and a somewhat edited version of what you hear tonight. We'll be broadcast on River to River on Thursday, and that first minute before we go into NPR News is called the billboard. So with your help, I'd like to make sure that our hands and our hoots are warmed up for Don Gagne. So we'll just do a little bit of creation here, the billboard. And it might take a one or two takes, but you'll get the idea here. I'll gesture with my left hand. Let's try this. And John Pemble's back there getting all the audio right. And I think we're going to try this out, huh, John? Okay, we're ready to go. Don's back there ready. I'm hoping he's ready. He was munching on the same things you've been munching on, so we'll try this out. This past summer, he crossed the state on rag bribe, along with two of his NPR colleagues. They called their trio No Pie Refused. And today, he joins us before a live audience. Please welcome NPR's Don Gagne. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We are thrilled to be at the venue at Court Center in Des Moines. Don Gagne is NPR's national political correspondent based in Washington, but he spends much of his time traveling throughout the U.S. covering campaigns. And of course, he frequents Iowa, especially during caucus season. And this hour, we want to talk with Don Gagne about current politics, his work, have him answer some of your questions, and see if Don can become an honorary Iowan by answering Iowa trivia sent in by you, our listeners. A special edition of River to River starts after this news. The alternative audience that was waiting in the alley, we can tell them to go home? Okay. These people are good. May I toast you, Don? Okay, here we go. Everybody, raise your glasses. Welcome to Politics and a Pint. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this past summer, our special guest today crossed the state on his bike, along with two of his NPR colleagues, Scott Horsley and Brian Naylor, as part of Rag Bribe. They called their trio No Pie Refused. And today, he joins us before a live audience. Say hello to NPR's Don Gagne.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are thrilled to be at the venue at Court Center in downtown Des Moines before a live audience and pints of all types all around in hand. Hoppy, malty, citrusy, piney, all kinds. And Don Gagne, welcome to our stage in this venue.
Thank you for having me. It's one of my favorite cities. I love coming to Des Moines and watching you record the billboard and do all this. I've been in radio 32 years now, and I just love live radio. This is really, this is fun. So thank you.
Since it is called Politics and a Pint, we raise our glasses to politics and beverages.
Cheers.
Beverages, as Stephen Colbert, I guess, yes, would say, wouldn't he? This is, by the way, a brew that you might recognize because you were on Rag Bri this past year. You passed through Knoxville, was
yes,
one of our overnights there. Mm-hmm. This is actually from a brewery, the Peace Tree Brewery. We're drinking Blonde Fatale from Peace Tree Brewery.
Fabulous. Well, actually, that's fabulous because we were told to go to the Peace Tree Brewery, and I didn't make it at the end of a long day. So I'm really, thank you. This is good.
Don Gagne, you are an NPR national political correspondent based in Washington. You spend much of your time, however, outside of Washington, traveling throughout the United States, covering campaigns, elections, and also just getting a feel for the general political climate throughout parts of the country. And of course, we love having you visiting Iowa, and you do that especially during the caucus season. which is coming up. Though we never really stop, though, do we?
And there's a poll out.
And there's a new poll out. Yes, we could go into that. This hour, we want to talk to you about the current political climate, your work, and have some questions from the audience, hopefully. Later, we're going to put you to the test with a trivia game that we're calling, What Does Gagné Actually Know About Iowa Anyway? And to tell you, to give you, make you a little bit nervous, what's at stake here, Don, is nothing less than becoming an honorary Iowan. Okay?
Are there questions about the Music Man?
No. As a matter of fact, no.
Because I know the Music Man.
I'm sorry. We've had the NSA looking into your knowledge, and we've avoided that area precisely for that reason. Let's talk a little bit about the year that was, a year that began with optimism for President Obama. He won re-election, his signature law soon to take effect at the beginning of 2013 in Congress. Republicans, Democrats seem to be finding some common ground on gun control, also on long-awaited immigration reform. Now 2013 closes in a quite different manner. We finish up with one of the least productive years in history on Capitol Hill. And I want to have you in a moment talk about what you pull out of 2013 as a political year, but we've had some news here that I'd like to have you comment on first here in Iowa that will affect the nation. The longtime congressman, nine-term congressman Tom Latham of Iowa's 3rd District, who has served since 1994, has announced that he will not seek re-election in 2014. This is the type of news that a political correspondent like you jumps on. So what are your first thoughts?
First, it is a surprise. I don't know if it's a total shock, but it is a surprise. I mean, we have had a year when some members of Congress, members of the United States Senate, who we hadn't expected to step down, have said, I think I'm done. I'm not going to seek re-election next go-around. So against that backdrop, it's not a total shock. But I don't know of anybody who said this about Tom Latham. And I think immediately it makes what was already going to be a very big year in Iowa with an open Senate seat, an open House seat, because Bruce Braley is running for that Senate seat, and a governor's race. Add this to the mix, and you're going to get a lot of attention here a year early.
A few days ago, we had the remarkable press conference given by House Speaker John Boehner, in which he gave the "Are you kidding me?" quote. Do you see a link there with what Latham, or possible? It's all speculation at this point.
It's speculation. We do know that that Latham and Boehner are not just kindred spirits. They're very close friends.
Golf buddies.
Golf buddies, and I think cigar buddies, and yeah. So it's not outrageous to think that that the frustrations that Boehner expressed in a very unusually theatrical way for him is something that Latham is feeling as well. And frankly, it's hard to think of a lot of other reasons why he would decide to end what everybody thought was going to be, you know, a political career that lasted many more years. Obviously, we don't know for sure, but they're Boehner, Latham, they're kind of establishment guys, you know, part of the leadership. And that's been a tough job this year, talking about how the year has gone. So
let's widen our scope a little bit past that news of recent to talk about 2013. When you look back at your coverage of the White House, of Washington politics, what stands out for you in 2013?
I think it's the degree to which the Obama administration started having troubles right off the bat. As the president started a second term on a real high. You know, he's coming off a re-election victory that was a bigger win than a lot of people might have predicted, given the state of the economy and going into the last election year. But you do expect a president reelected to get a bit of a honeymoon, and it seems like there was just zero honeymoon. I mean, it kind of felt like the honeymoon was over almost before he was sworn in, before he took the oath the second time. And the list of things that went wrong, some were big, some were smaller, but telling, started right away. You may recall, I mean, everybody recalls, a year ago, you know, the school shootings at Sandy Hook. And
you covered that.
One year ago today, I was in Sandy Hook. And,
What can you say?
What can you say? What can you say? But the president and was going to use that moment to push for some sort of legislation that might put some limits on magazine ownership or certain kinds of guns, and nothing happened, and that actually died pretty early on in the new Congress. But you can just kind of go down the list. I mean, they did have an improving economy, and the unemployment rate now is the lowest it's been in 5 years. It just ticked downward again to 7 points even. It's way lower than that here in Iowa, obviously. It's a state that's long been beating the national average there. But the bad things, the litany of bad things, the failed talks, again, very early on in the year, that resulted in the sequester that nobody said they wanted, and it sure wasn't popular, but those mandatory budget cuts kicked in. Again, that wasn't just the president's fault. It was, in fact, many would say it was the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party's fault, but it's a failure to reach some sort of a deal, and that reflects poorly on the White House. It certainly reflected poorly on the Republican Congress as well. More White House stuff, though. The controversy over the phone records of the AP, the Associated Press, having been...
But strangely, almost... You know, faded by now, isn't it? Or there, not? Or perhaps among media people not.
No, most of these early ones have faded, and they've been kind of overtaken by the NSA scandal, which is also on the list, and the Edward Snowden stuff, and the troubles with Syria. I mean, it looked like we were heading to perhaps some sort of a conflict there before... the Russians and Vladimir Putin kind of brokered a deal that allowed everybody to step back, a deal that was not widely praised either across the board politically. But anyway, that has cooled down, but that's relatively recent. And then the big one, of course, coming right on the heels of the government shutdown. And again, the government shutdown was something that tended to benefit the White House a bit, because of the way the public viewed Republicans and the Tea Party caucus as being at fault there. But it's not like it did anybody real favors. Then came the rollout of the Affordable Care Act website, healthcare.gov, and the troubles which seem to have been arrested now. People are signing up. The website seems to be working. Not 100%. Certainly, but that's just, a portion of what happened this year. Some of those things very big, some of those things smaller, but all of which added up to a year in which we saw the president's approval ratings start in the mid to high 50s and slide down to the mid to low 40s where they are now. They might have bumped up a little bit in the past couple of weeks. And you don't want to focus too much on any one poll, obviously, but you can look at the trend line. And, as someone put it, I read, he's now kind of into that territory where George W. Bush was in, his worst days of his second term. And he's still got 3+ years to go. The second term's less than a year old.
If you just joined us, Don Gagne is my guest in this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is Politics and a Pint. Don and I drinking a a pint of beer together before a live audience in Des Moines, part of IPR's Insight series. We're at the venue at Court Center in Des Moines before an enthusiastic audience with plenty of questions for you later, Don, I would guess.
Excellent.
You mentioned the Tea Party. Let's talk about them because they are, I would have to think, as a national political correspondent, one of the most interesting things to cover as a factor here. Coming onto the scene as that economic turmoil, near global economic collapse happened at the end of 2008, the end of George Bush's presidency into the beginning of the Obama presidency. So where do you see them in 2013 and how will they move into 2014, especially considering that now so there's a very obvious split in the GOP with the House Speaker's comments of recent?
The Tea Party has not yet had its fifth birthday yet. Its kind of official beginning was on Tax Day in 2009. They were inspired and driven by the talk of and then the eventual introduction of the Affordable Care Act. That was the driving force from the beginning, and it remains a driving force of the Tea Party. In that law, they were the first to call it Obamacare. The president at some point embraced that name. Now we all kind of use that name as a shorthand, but they see in that bill a symbol of everything that is wrong with big government. So if you look at last year, the election year, 2012, across the board, you can say pretty much flat out that it was a rough year for the Tea Party. The president got reelected. Democrats picked up seats in the election. They failed to get a nominee of their liking on the Republican side for all the talk of their clout within the party. They never really found a candidate that they coalesced behind. For a while, they liked Newt Gingrich. For a while, they liked Herman Cain. They kind of took turns going from one candidate to the next, never quite getting on board with Mitt Romney. And that was a very dispiriting year for them. And there was even talk at the end of last year, has the Tea Party kind of faded? Have they played out? Are they going to go away? Then the budget battles started this year. And I don't know if it was the worst year for the Tea Party yet or the best year for the Tea Party yet. I mean, obviously that 2010 year was their really big year when they played such an important role in the 2010 elections. But this was a year where if they didn't accomplish a lot, they really reasserted their role within the Republican Party, and especially within the Republican caucus, within the U.S. House. I mean, they gave...
How do you see that relationship, John Boehner handling this Tea Party caucus going forward?
He seemed to put a marker down with that press conference last week. When he did the...
Signaling what?
Signaling that he is tired of dealing with them, period. And I mean, I think that's the signal. And you saw it in that moment where he said, after the government shut down, some of them were quoted as saying, well, we really didn't think our strategy would work. And he gave that kind of animated, are you kidding me? with his eyes kind of bugging out. I mean, it was not what you would call a calibrated response. it was a very theatrical response. But I think it was calculated. It was calculated to send a message that there is going to be pushback, and that the Tea Party might not have as much clout within the caucus. Nobody's going to handle them with kid gloves. Now, we had seen signs of that in advance. The Chamber of Commerce during the government shutdown. Again, the Chamber of Commerce tends to back Republicans. They were very critical and were already pushing back and are talking about running ads against Tea Party candidates, which is something they haven't really done before. So you got that early version of the establishment fights back, if we can kind of give it a Star Wars movie name,
All right.
Boehner seems to be a much more aggressive version of that.
Let's talk a little bit, focus in on our state, the Iowa caucuses, and its pivotal role in the nomination process for presidential candidates. 2 years from now, we will be in the final days leading up to the 2016 Iowa caucuses. You will have crisscrossed Iowa many times in the intervening time, and some may say shame on us for talking about it 2 years in advance, but we want to do that right
now.
Yeah,
what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? What do you think about Iowa's role? We're always a little bit worried in this country, I guess we're not secessionist yet, but I guess made us kind of secessionist, but about losing relevancy in this nominating process with this prize spot. How do you see Iowa's role in the nominating process, and will we remain as strong and as influential as we have been in the past couple of decades?
It's not my job to offer reassurances here, but I actually think I can do just that. And the reason I say it is, as long as Iowa's first in the nation status, or hashtag FITN, right, on Twitter, as long as it's working for at least one party,
yes,
that party will be an advocate for doing it again next time. Republicans have had some problems with the Iowa caucus in terms of the caucuses launching a candidate off to New Hampshire, where they can win that and they coast to a nomination. Mike Huckabee didn't become the nominee after 2008, and we certainly know what happened in 2012 in the Iowa caucuses. I mean, certainly there was the lack of a real result on caucus night, with the problems counting the votes and the need to kind of retally them, but ultimately Rick Santorum was the winner.
By eight votes,
and I got the call that Santorum had won as I was waking up one morning in my hotel room in Charleston, South Carolina. So I was already two states removed from Iowa before I found out who had won Iowa. Again, Santorum hung in there and actually ran a pretty competitive race against Romney, but was always behind. And, you know, it was pretty clear it was Romney's to win, especially as the field, or Romney's to lose, especially as the field was winnowed down a little bit. But if you go to the other side, Barack Obama, Senator Obama, ran kind of a classic caucus campaign. I mean, his folks understood the caucus, understood the difference between the rules on the Democratic side and the rules on the Republican side, which are significant. They're two very different kinds of contests, appreciated in ways that the Senator Hillary Clinton campaign didn't, that you want to be people's first choice, but it's also really great to be somebody's second choice or third choice, because in the Democratic caucus process, under those rules, those people can come to you. Right. They won. It worked. It launched his campaign, gave it a credibility that it had lacked to that point. It had a lot of fascination and intrigue and potential. But at that moment, at the convention center or at the Hy-Vee Center or somewhere, election night, when he gave that victory speech, that was the first time a lot of people said, this guy could be the president of the United States. The very first time a lot of people said it. So
you have covered the presidency in the White House, George W. Bush, but the candidate, President Obama, and then Senator Obama, as you said. Contrast the candidate Obama with the president in his second term now, Obama.
That election seems so far away. It really does, that campaign. I mean, first, he did. He campaigned on hope and change. That's the shorthand. And he was a different kind of candidate. And he didn't see America in terms of red states and blue states and Democrats and Republicans. And he was going to bring the country together and find new ways of doing politics. And whether it was his fault or not, that just didn't play out the way he had planned in his
first
term.
Was there a moment when you saw that turn, that sea change happen in Obama, from the candidate, the vision of the future that he seemed to capture with the Americans?
You didn't see it so much in his manner and his techniques and tactics, but you did notice it in the results. So when the Affordable Care Act, we're going to be talking about the Affordable Care Act for the rest of our lives probably, right? as kind of one of those landmark moments in American politics. But when it passed with no Republican votes, you could see that the opposition had hardened, and that no matter what kind of entreaties he made, he was going to have a hard time. And then came the 2010 elections, where Democrats lost a lot of seats and Republicans made gains. And since then, it's really been the president, at war with the Republicans, and it feels like it's as partisan as it has ever been. I mean, I haven't been in Washington that long, but I've been watching these things closely for most of my life. And you go back and listen to some of his speeches from 2008, and they seem very idealistic, but they don't seem to reflect what we're seeing. And then, maybe just to kind of bring this to just a bit of a close, when he ran for re-election, it was not the campaign that he ran in 2008. You did get some soaring rhetoric, but most of it was appealing to the base. Get Democrats to turn out. Don't let those other guys get in, because they'll undo everything we've tried to do, and we're not done yet. And it was a very, very, very focused campaign in terms of getting out the loyalists.
Don Gagne is with us, a special edition of River to River, Politics and a Pint. We're at the venue at Court Center in Des Moines before a live audience. And before we try to see if you're up to becoming an honorary Iowan, I had a couple more questions. We want to know what happens behind the scenes for you as a national political correspondent, having covered now two presidents. What's a scene, what's a story you can tell us that will illustrate sort of your day-to-day activities in getting a story, in pursuing a story that we only get to hear the and relish the end product of?
A good example is what I did just a couple of weeks ago in North Carolina. I was in Charlotte and Greensboro, and where else did I go? I went to Selma, North Carolina. Until I got there, I didn't even know there was a Selma, North Carolina. As a national political correspondent, my focus at NPR, after having spent 10 full years inside the bubble, either of the White House or of campaigns, my focus has been to get way outside the bubble and get away from the place where they hand you the schedule in the morning. This is all our movements. This is when you need to be on the bus. This is when you need to be up for the security sweep. This is when we're wheels up. This is when we're wheels down. This is when the event starts. This is when the event ends. This is the 30 minutes of filing time you have, because that's when the buses roll to get you to the plane, to get you to the, you get where I'm going, right? That's kind of your life when you're the White House correspondent or the lead correspondent on a presidential campaign. You're the person who's there all the time with the principal, but you don't have a lot of time to breathe and to say, I'd like to go check that out over there. Now my job is to do almost nothing but go check that thing out that's over there. And I will go to Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'll have made a couple of calls. There's, you know, PPP polling is based in the state. I know a couple of really fantastic political analysts and people I'll touch bases with. In this particular case, I was doing an early check-in on one of those places where there's an incumbent Democratic U.S. senator who is in a red or a red-leaning state. So you have Democratic U.S. Senator Kay Hagan, who's seeking re-election for the first time in North Carolina, which went for Obama by a whisker in 08, but went for Romney by a slightly bigger whisker in 2012. It's a state that's got a lot of interesting things happening demographically, but it's still a place that we kind of think of as a red state that may turn purple and may turn someday, but it's a battleground. So the senator wasn't particularly interested in talking about that story, how she might be in trouble.
Understandably.
this early, because she was a strong supporter too of Obamacare. And there are already, a year before the election, hundreds of thousands of ads on television attacking her over that vote. She doesn't even have an opponent yet. There are, half a dozen people who hope to win the Republican primary in May. So groups like, Americans for Prosperity and I think Freedom Works and, some of these kind of outside conservative groups have been pouring money into attack ads. So I had to kind of go do that story. I knew there were pollsters to talk to. I knew I wasn't going to get the candidate. So I had to find people to talk to. And one of the great, great, great things about Iowa is you come to this state and you walk into the diner and you tell them you're a reporter. Would you like to talk politics for 15 minutes? They tell you to have a seat. They tell you to order breakfast. Sometimes they offer to buy you breakfast and you have a great conversation about politics. You go to North Carolina a year before a midterm election, and you kind of have to explain to them who you are and not scare them away with your big microphone. Yep. And you have about 20 seconds to kind of make the pitch and convince them to talk. So here's what I do. I go to the library when I get to a town because the librarians know everybody and they know everything that's happening. And they tell me where there's a community meeting going on that night. They tell me what diner to go to. They show me all of the local newspapers all there in one spot. Sometimes all the newspapers from the state. So I don't go to the front pit section. I go to the sports section and I look to see if there's a junior high football game or something like that. Because guess what? There's going to be people standing on the sideline. And some of them are there like really watching their kid. But some of them kind of got dragged along. They're kind of bored. And they don't mind a reporter coming up to them and say, while we're waiting for the next play, can we talk politics for a minute? And you ask for a one-minute conversation, and sometimes they talk to you for 10 or 15. But what I found in Selma, North Carolina, was that there was the Selma Christmas Parade on a Tuesday night in December. And I thought, this is perfect. I mean, it's really rude to, be at a Christmas parade a year before an election and start talking politics with people. But I knew they'd be lined up on the street in tiny little downtown Selma with nothing to do for an hour or more before the parade started. And I found really kind of magical and representative comments from people. So it's kind of like a scavenger hunt, and you need kind of one from column A and one from column B and one from column C, but you don't actually have the list of things you need. You just kind of need things that kind of fit in a story, and when you've got the story, only then do you relax and say, oh, okay, I think I've got something here, and then you write it and get it on the air. And it's kind of always different, too. That's the other thing. But that's how that one worked. And it's you have to like that. And you have to kind of like the uncertainty of it. But it's fun.
Don Gagne, my guest on this special edition of River to River, Politics and a Pint, with Don Gagne, NPR's national political correspondent. Now, you certainly have gotten to know Iowa in your reporting over the course of many years, but this summer you got to know Iowa in a much different way. You took part in RAGBRAI, the Register's annual great bike ride across Iowa, along with two of your NPR colleagues. Was it Scott Horsley and Brian Naylor?
Yes, yep, two guys. And our, if you go to NPR, our cubicles are like adjacent
right
to one another.
So you're joined at the hip.
We joined at the hip, both on vacation and at work.
That was would be an interesting looking bicycle if you were all joined at the hip.
It would.
Your team, your trio, your team was called No Pie Refused. This is one of the things that, of course, RAGBRAI is known for. I went my first. We didn't run into each other with 15,000 riders.
Yes.
I guess it's believable that we wouldn't run into each other. But so your team, No Pie Refused.
And just Scott Horsley gets credit for coming up with the No Pie Refused. It was NPR No Pie Refused, right? But that was on our backs because we wanted people to know we were from NPR. And on the front, there was a bicycle, and I think Scott drew it. And Scott's not a great artist, I will say that. But but it was a bicycle with pies for wheels. And then it said 24-hour news cycle. So that was our uniform. $10 T-shirts.
Your estimation of how many pieces of pie that your trio ate or you personally ate?
Over a week. Probably 20 pieces of pie, each of us, maybe.
Good job.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, you're burning it off.
Okay, now we're
going to
compare.
So it's okay.
Now we're going to compare favorites.
I had more pie than pork chops, but not by much.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Pork Chop.
Yes.
Yes. Your favorite piece of pie?
I forget the city. I want to say, it was the first stop, and it was the peach pie a la mode at the Lions Club in whatever the first city was.
Really? Mine was a raisin pie. I'd never had it before, prepared by some Mennonite women. That was just marvelous.
Amazing! It's amazing.
If you could pick an image from RAGBRAI to leave us with, what would it be that made a huge impression that surprised you, perhaps?
You know, the first couple of days and in the months leading up to it, we'd never done anything like this. And I would go on like long bike rides in Washington and in Maryland, but there are no hills there. So you go for a long bike ride and it's flat. And everybody would say, well, good thing Iowa's flat. And you kind of, as you know, it's not. So the hills were what terrified me. And the hills almost killed me the first day before I figured out that you can't try to power up every hill. You have to just kind of sit back. But I remember like on the second or third day when I finally kind of found the rhythm and knew I was going to be okay. And it was early in the morning, so it's kind of foggy and misty. And you come over a hill, and it's that long row of riders just kind of going off to infinity. And
isn't that amazing?
It's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. It really is. Yeah.
Don Gagne is with us, NPR national political correspondent. And now, Don, before we get to audience questions, we want to have you play a game with us. And there is a reward for your achievement in this game. But we'd like to have you play a game that we're calling What Does Gagne Actually Know About Iowa Anyway? And here's how it works. We have 10 multiple choice questions based on Iowa trivia. They are sent in by our listeners. We've solicited them over the last few weeks over the air. By the way, thank you so much for sending in so many bits of Iowa trivia. We have over 100 very interesting facts of Iowa trivia. We had the tortuous task of selecting only 10 to make into questions for you, Don. But thank you all of you Iowa Public Radio listeners for being so responsive in coming up with trivia that will astound you. Anyway, what's at stake for you, Don? Depending on how you answer, you will be given a certain degree of Iowa honorary citizenship status as decreed by Iowa Public Radio. You answer 8 to 10 correct, and you will be given the title, Wow, you have more smarts than a birthday spanking. That's 8 to 10 correct. Answer 6 to 8 correct, 6 to 7, I guess that would be correct. You earn the title, where you been hiding your second brain, Don? Answer only 3 to 5 correct, and you will be known as Iowa. We're going to blame that on the beer, Don. and answer less than three correct, we'll give you the rather meager Iowa honorary title of Iowannabe.
So I might argue.
You ready?
That doing RAGBRAI and spending like 1,000 nights in Iowa hotels in the last 10 years might give me honorary Iowa citizenship.
We'll submit that to the committee. This is okay. Not a decision I can make alone. Okay. We make that together as Iowans, don't we? Yes. Okay. Okay, question number one for Don Gagne in our quiz. Nathan M. Pusey of Council Bluffs was the first person born west of the Mississippi River to become the president of what? A, Harvard University, B, the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, or C, the NRA?
What's the name again?
Nathan M. Pusey of Council Bluffs, the first person born west of the Mississippi River to become the president of what? Harvard University, the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, or the NRA?
There have been many people west of the Mississippi who've been the president of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. I don't know if this was the first. I'm going to say Harvard University.
Don Gagne, you were right.
Hey.
Oh. And we have a scorekeeper here. Dennis Goldford is with us in the audience. Dennis, would you stand up? Our political analyst on Politics Wednesday. And Dennis, because my brain is already so addled by the beer, Dennis is going to be our scorekeeper. So we're one for one. Dennis's job is to keep track of that to see what degree of honorary Iowa citizenship.
I don't know how many times I've made a frantic call to Dennis on deadline, telling him something has happened. I need you to help me make sense of it. And I even once went to his home and met his dog, and he was not in his pajamas, but thank you. And if you put your thumb on the scale here, that's okay.
Don Gagne, you are one for one in our Iowa trivia quiz. Second question. At one time, muscatine was known worldwide as a premier source for what? A, brass instrument mouthpieces, B, pickled pig's feet, or C, pearl buttons?
Some people are saying pearl buttons.
Oh, okay.
And it would be rude of me to disagree with them.
You're going to go with pearl buttons?
I'm going to go with pearl buttons.
It could be a ruse.
It could be a ruse. This is Iowa. They wouldn't do that.
Okay, pearl buttons. Let's wait a minute. With the answer is the Iowa Public Radio listener who's from Marshalltown, born and raised in Muscatine, who sent in this piece of trivia. Dave Perkins with the answer.
At one point, Muscatine was known as the pearl button capital of the world. There were fires all up and down the river. We see people boiling out the shellfish harvested from the Mississippi River to make pearl buttons that were exported all around the world. My grandfather owned one of the many button factories. I have a brother who works in one of the two remaining ones, although it's all plastics now. I remember watching the automatic button cutting machines when I was a kid in the button factory. It belonged to my grandfather, and my father ran for a while.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay. We're friendly to outer staters. We'll see how much help you get in the next ones. Okay, here, Don Gagne. Dennis Goldford, score here?
Two rights, none wrong.
Two rights, none wrong. Two for two. Question number three for Don Gagne. In 1839, Iowa experienced the Honey War, which was a dispute over the border with Missouri. During the tension, Missouri officials tried to collect taxes from people that claimed to be in Iowa, but they refused to pay. So instead, the Missouri tax collectors did what? A, submitted scathing op-ed commentaries in local newspapers, most notably the Honey Press. B, they chopped down Iowans' trees that were prized for containing honeybee hives. Or C, they smeared honey on doorknobs of Iowans who were delinquent on taxes.
Oh. I like C, but I'm going to go with B, cutting down the trees.
You think that the Missouri, they would do that?
Yeah.
The Missouri, they would go across the border.
Yeah.
I hear a murmur out there. I don't think the audience is quite as knowledgeable on this one, but perhaps. You're going to go with what again?
I think it was B, the cutting down of the trees.
That is correct.
All right. All right.
amazingly, the matter was eventually settled by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Really?
Yes. It looked as though violence would start. The Missouri troops were dismissed. Missouri's jurisdiction was withdrawn back to a compromise line. Iowa troops went home. The so-called war was over. No one was killed or injured.
Well,
the Iowa
thank
war.
Goodness.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Dennis Goldford, the score here?
3 rights, none wrong.
All right.
Wow. Okay. Right. You're on your way to being smart as a birthday spanking.
Yes.
Okay. Number 4. The Des Moines Lobe is what? A neighborhood in Des Moines with a tradition of campaigning for Dave Loebsack. B, a flat area in northern Iowa formed by glaciers. Or C, a part of the brain that uniquely enables a person to mentally ignore the smell of hog manure and other unpleasant farm smells.
Again, I like C, and it may indeed be true. Has to be, right?
Right. You know, you go to a farm, and instantly you say, this is a different smell than I have in suburbia.
Yes.
But you get used to it, right?
Yeah,
so
yes.
So wouldn't it make sense that there would be some...
No, it makes great sense, but I think it's more of a geography thing. I think it's B.
Okay. A flat area in northern Iowa formed by glaciers. Yes. Let's listen to the listener, IOPR listener, who sent in this bit of trivia, Jennifer Nealand from Tama, for the answer.
The Des Moines Lobe is the flattest part of Iowa. I know some people that traverse Interstate 29 in western Iowa might claim their area of the Missouri Valley is the flattest part, but the Des Moines Lobe, with its recently glaciated topography, is the largest flattest area in Iowa.
The flattest part of Iowa. Congratulations.
May Reg Bry go through there next year.
Scorekeeper Dennis Goldford.
Don, you've passed mere Iowa wannabe status. You're now up to 4 and ascending.
All right. Question number 5 out of 10 for Don Gagne, NPR national political correspondent. In 1920, a new mayor of Davenport, Dr. Charles Bearwald, took office. It was a sweeping victory for himself and other members of his political party, which also won a majority of the seats on the city council. He was the first and so far only member of this party to serve as Davenport's mayor. Was he A, a Democrat, B, a Republican, C, a socialist, D, a member of the Farm Labor Party, or E, a fascist? Democrat, Republican, socialist, Farm Labor Party, or fascist? Dr. Charles Bearwald, 1920.
1920. I'm going to go with socialist.
I'm going to go with socialist. C. Does the audience think that's a good guess? Pretty timid out there, 150 of you out there. Pretty. Okay.
I've never heard of the fascist party.
C, socialist, is correct.
All right.
Amazing. We are Dennis Goldford. This is amazing. It's no wonder he's an NPR political correspondent.
He's pitching a perfect game. 5-0.
5-5 for 5. Number 6. The Cedar County Cow War. This is a real thing. We did not make this up.
People sent these in.
Yes. All of these.
Wow.
And we did not make up any of the alternatives either. They are real things that actually exist. The Cedar County Cow War in 1931 involved an opposition to testing dairy cows. There was a concern a certain disease would spread to humans when they drank the milk. Apparently, veterinarians attempting to do the testing were subjected to minor levels of violence, such as having eggs or mud thrown at them and getting kicked by farm wives. What were these veterinarians testing for in the Cedar County Cow War in 1931? A, tuberculosis, B, polio, or C, bovine cat scratch fever? Tuberculosis, polio, bovine cat scratch fever.
I was going to say this is just a guess, but that would imply the others weren't also just guesses. let's say tuberculosis.
Okay, and here with the correct answer is the woman who works at the Iowa City Public Library. I know her well. Maeve Clark from the Iowa City with the answer to the bit of trivia that she submitted for this test.
Cedar County Cow Wars happened because two veterinarians came to Cedar County to test the cows for tuberculosis, and the farmers didn't want this to happen. In fact, they sent the veterinarians to a farmer, Jake Lanker's house, and he was guarded by 65 deputies. But when they got there, the two veterinarians with the 65 deputies, there were a group of 500 farmers on the farm to stop them. And then 1,800 National Guard soldiers arrived in Tipton, and they came to protect the state veterinarians, and they had machine guns, which they placed at crossroads. And the soldiers also enforced the state law with bayonets.
I love your listeners. This is great.
Machine, I do too. Machine guns and bayonets. We got in on the Cedar County Cow Wars.
So I'm a Jimmy Rogers fan. We have Jimmy Rogers one. Of course, it's Clay, and he had a hit song back in the 20s, the TB Blues. So that was why I guessed tuberculosis.
Okay,
that's a public radio thing.
Dennis Goldford, we have.
Yeah.
This is amazing, isn't it?
I'm really fun at parties.
Let's to turn up Dennis Goldford's microphone, please. Okay, go ahead, Dennis.
I was sick that day in grade school when we had to learn to count this high. But six right, none wrong.
All right.
Well, he's avoided the we're blaming it on the beer. And while you're sipping a beer. Very good. Very good, Don Gagne. Question number 7. Two Iowans have received the Nobel Peace Prize. The most well-known is Norman Borlaug for his work advancing agricultural production techniques. The other was a man named John Mott. He was the long-serving leader of what? Trees Forever? A, Trees Forever. B, the Order of the Sons of Italy in America. C, the YMCA. Or D, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Colorado's Naropa University.
I don't know that that gets you a Nobel. Peace Prize, anyway. It might get you.
So you're going to say it's not D, the Jack Kerouac.
I think I can rule out Jack Kerouac.
Okay. So you're left with Trees Forever, the Order of the Sons of Italy in America, or the YMCA.
I'm going to say YMCA.
Answer is C. You're right.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
Mott was recognized for establishing and strengthening international Protestant Christian student organizations that work to promote peace. 7 for 7, Dennis, the way I see it.
That's right.
Number 8. We're closing in on the end here, the home stretch. Fayette, Iowa is home to Upper Iowa University. It's the only town in Iowa that has a college or university, but does not have what? A, a water tower. B, B, a brick and mortar campus. C, a high school. Or D, a sense of humor.
I've been there.
You've been to Fayette, okay. Beautiful part of the state.
I don't recall seeing a water tower. No, I think a high school.
You're going to go with high school. Audience thinks high school. I think you've got a lot of agreement out there.
Yeah. I mean, every place has a high school, but the way you said...
I tipped you off, you think?
But, yeah, I think high school.
Okay. The Iowa Public Radio listener who gave us this bit of trivia for this question, Tom Wickersham from Cedar Falls, tell us what the answer is.
Due to a number of mergers in public schools in Iowa, Fayette no longer has a high school.
Wow.
Did he say murders?
Merger.
Mergers. I thought he said murders. I thought, okay. I thought that's really odd.
Oh, my. Don, you've been out east too long.
Yeah. You can edit
you come
that,
from
right?
Detroit,
you can just
you?
Yeah, snip can. That out for the broadcast.
Dennis?
Well, you know, if you get to 10-0, somebody's going to want you to run for governor here. But 8 right, none wrong.
Or you go to the Rose Bowl.
Question 9. Question 9, also of a political nature for Don Gagne. Which First Lady of the United States is not from Iowa? A, Mamie Dowd Eisenhower, B, Lou Henry Hoover, or C, Bess Truman?
So I'm sorry, one more time with the three of them. Truman, Mamie Bess.
First Lady, not from Iowa, Mamie Eisenhower, Lou Henry Hoover, Bess Truman, A, B, C.
If it's a trick question, it's Hoover.
So if it's a Grant's Tomb question, no. I don't know. Well. Wow.
Hoover.
Lou Henry Hoover, B is your answer. That is incorrect, Don.
Oh.
The correct answer is Mrs. Truman. Mrs. Truman was from Independence, Missouri. Mrs. Hoover was from Waterloo. Mrs. Eisenhower, Mamie Eisenhower, from Boone, Iowa.
Okay.
All right. How does it feel to get one wrong?
And, you know, I was just starting to care.
Well, your last question. This will decide whether you get 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 correct. Correct, Dennis Goldford?
That's right.
Okay. So he's still very high on the rung here. The very first Iowa territorial Supreme Court case was decided in July of 1839. It was the case of a Missouri man who made an agreement with his slave that allowed the slave to reside in the Iowa Territory to earn money to purchase his freedom. 1839. The ruling outlawed slavery in Iowa long before the Emancipation Proclamation. The case is known as what? Is it A, concerning the nature of Cornelius? B, regarding the matter of Ralph? C, toward the repatriation of Toby? Or D, for the release of Fred?
Can I hear the actual question again?
Cool. So this is long before Iowa was a state, or a few years. Iowa was a territorial entity, has a Supreme Court case, the very first one, decided in July of 1839. The case of a Missouri man who made an agreement with his slave that allowed the slave to reside in Iowa Territory to earn money to purchase his freedom. So the ruling outlawed slavery in Iowa long before Abe Lincoln did with the Emancipation Proclamation. The case is known as, do you want me to repeat those as well?
Okay. There was nobody named Fred. I mean, that's a little too.
Frederick.
It'd be Frederick.
Frederick?
Yeah. So we'll eliminate that one.
Okay, we're going to eliminate D. So what we have left is concerning the nature of Cornelius, regarding the manner of Ralph, toward the repatriation of Toby, is C.
I'm going to go with Cornelius.
Concerning the nature of Cornelius.
No. It's not Fred, is it?
You're getting some moans and groans out there.
Ralph. Really? Ralph.
Could be another ruse.
I'll stick with Cornelius.
You're going to stick with Cornelius. Concerning the nature of Cornelius, here with the correct answer, the IPR listener who submitted this bit of trivia, Jerome Thompson is the state curator for the State Historical Society of Iowa. Give it to us, Jerome.
This is the case of Ralph, which basically ruled that Ralph, who was a slave for an owner in Missouri and working in Iowa and the lead mines of Dubuque, was extended equal protection, and thus it ruled that slavery was illegal in Iowa. It's also important to note that Ralph was not the only person who was enslaved and living in Iowa. It's not clear what other people owning slaves in Iowa thought about it.
State curator for the State Historical Society of Iowa, Jerome Thompson, thank you for that submission. Don Gagne, I'm sorry. 8 of 10 is pretty darn good.
All right, thank you.
And with that, we decree you honorary Iowan with the title, Iowa. Wow, you have more smarts than a birthday spanking.
All right, I'm honored.
Are you old enough to ever have had a birthday spanking?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So things we don't talk about anymore, yeah. Do we?